Well, I call your attention this evening to 2 Samuel chapter 5. 2 Samuel chapter 5. The message tonight is entitled Jerusalem Captured. Jerusalem Captured. We'll cover verses 6 through 10 this evening. And I'll remind the deacons after church tonight, we'll have our monthly meeting. And so you men don't forget about that. Last week, we talked about David and his anointing. It was the third time that he was anointed, the first time when he was about a 16-year-old boy. Then, 7.5 years prior to his age now, he's about 30. Here he's about 37 and a half, I guess 38 years old. On the third anointing, he's that age. But he was anointed to be king over Judah, which was just basically one large geographical location in the southern part of Israel. But God's hand was always behind the scene working his plan. Ishbosheth is murdered. Abner dies as a fool. And so the people come to David when they realize that he was not behind either of those killings. And they begin to coalesce behind him. And so last week we saw that they anointed him for the third and final time to be king over the whole nation. And so tonight what we're going to look at is we're going to look at a decision that David makes. And this decision is to move his headquarters from Hebron to a place that will ultimately be called Jerusalem. In the Old Testament, it was a city that was up on a hill and it was called Jebus. It was a Jesuit or a Jesuite city. The Jesuites lived there, or Jehuites, and they considered themselves to be in a place that was impregnable. They did not think that anybody could conquer them because they had withstood so much over the centuries. From the time of Abraham until the time of David is 1,200 years. And you've got young David that is the king, but the old patriarch Abraham, who lived many millennia before, he had been promised by God a certain land. And the first time that we see this group of people, they are known as the Canaanites. They are a Canaanite people. In Genesis chapter 10, you have a man named Canaan. He was the third son of one of Noah's boys named Ham. And so you've got Cain, or Canaanites, who were the offspring of Canaan. And they lived in this area hundreds of years. You also find this geographical location in Genesis 22. And I hope that you won't hold me to every one of these references because our Wi-Fi didn't work and I didn't print my notes. So I'm doing this from memory and a couple of things that I jotted down. But in Genesis 22, what you've got is you've got the story of Abraham offering Isaac on the altar. And the name of that mountain was called Mount Moriah. If you go to Israel today, they will say that Mount Moriah is where the Temple Mount property is located today. The Dome of the Rock, of course, is under control of the Arabs. But one of these days, it will be under control of King Jesus, and it'll be Jewish. But you've got The Canaanites that are mentioned in Numbers 13, you have them mentioned, I think, in Joshua 9, 11, and 24. And so you've got these people that have always inhabited this parcel of land. And so when we see now David and all of the leaders and all of those 350,000 people that came to his inauguration, I don't know how much time passed, but I know that the Bible tells us in verse number 6, and the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites. So in other words, we see first of all that David had a plan. And I'm going to give you some reasons at the end of the message, the four reasons that I've jotted down why I think that he wanted Jerusalem or Jebus. Why did he want that to be his capital? And I'll give you those at the end of the service this evening. But the first thing that I want you to notice is I want you to notice the plan. David seemed to always have an idea that he needed to implement. You know, there's some people that just seem to think a little farther ahead than other people. You have people that are able to see the dominoes a little farther out that are going to fall than just the average person. And I think that David was a man like this. I think that he looked at the situation and he realized that there needs to be a change in our capital. I think that the reason that he made those changes is probably similar to the reason that we have Washington, D.C. as our capital of our nation. We'll talk about that maybe in a little bit as well. But when you see in verse number 6 that the king and his men went to Jerusalem, you see that there is a body of people that are unified now. You don't have a faction of the Benjaminites over here, and you don't have a faction of the Danites up here. You don't have those factions that are all over the map. These people have finally tired of civil strife and civil war. They want to get along for once. And you will see for the next 80 years that this takes place. You have the reign of David, you have the reign of Solomon, and those reigns were in 40-year increments. And so for about 80 years, there's going to be a unification of this nation. Now, after Solomon, the kingdom is going to divide one more time. You're going to have Jeroboam go north, you're going to have Rehoboam go south. But for 80 years, there's a unified Israel. And so you've got this unity. They have all coalesced behind one person, and there's no doubt who that person is. That's David. And I want you to notice that David, how that he doesn't rest on his laurels. He doesn't sit back on his throne and go, give me some more praise. I mean, they've been giving him adoration, and you remember the party went on for 3 days. You had people that had brought bread, you had people that had brought cheeses, you had people that had brought their wineskins, you had food that had been brought in. You've got the people of Judah that kind of maybe took a back seat and did the serving of their brethren. Ishtar was one of them that served a little bit. A couple of others served. And you just had basically a big party, which was the inauguration of King David. Well, as the inauguration died down, David doesn't say, hey, start it up again. I like all of this praise. He didn't do that. What you see is you see him going to work to keep the unity and to keep the momentum going in the right direction. One of the pictures that you can think of is this. You can think of a snowball going downhill. You think how that, what does it do? It gets larger as it rolls, and it gets bigger and faster as it just kind of picks up momentum. And so you've got David and his kingdom. He's thinking, well, we've got a good thing going after this inauguration, and so now I need to let people know we've got a plan. And that plan is that headquarters, the capital, is no longer going to be Hebron. Now it's going to be Jerusalem. Well, the second thing that you see is how he motivates his men for this big job. And I'm going to tell you something. It is a big job. Jerusalem itself, or Jebus itself, was not a huge place, but it was up on a hill. And people that have been in the military, they know that a higher position is the advantage. When you're shooting down and you're fighting downward, it's a whole lot easier than fighting upward. I think I remember these numbers right. They said that on D-Day, when we invaded Normandy, when those Rangers were climbing up the hills and the cliffs, and they had hit that beach and they started climbing, I think that the number was 7,000 men that died in one day. That's a lot of blood. And so the Germans were shooting down on our troops. And so you've got the city of Jebus, and they're high up on a hill. There's a wall around this area. And it seems as though that it's a fortress that you will not be able to penetrate. And the reason I say that is because there's going to be some jeering, which I'll get to in a moment. But I want you to notice the motivation with me. Look at verse 8. And David said on that day, the day that they got there, he puts this word out to all of his people, "Whosoever getteth up to the gutter." That goes back to my first point about the plan. Most people would have said, well, how are we going to scale that wall? David already had another plan. He saw things that other people did not see. I want you to look with me at a picture. And there it goes. Let me see if I can turn this thing on. There we go. All right. His plan was this. Right here is a city wall. This is the ground. All right? Think about that ground right there. Can you hear me? Let me get back over here a little bit. That's the ground right here. All right? There's a city wall that's going up there. David and his men would be out here on top of the ground. But David somehow, maybe he had a spy, maybe because he had spent time around this area fighting Philistines. This area right down here is a fresh water supply called the Gihon Springs. It's still there today. And there are several things that take place because of the Gihon Springs. And so David simply says this. He said, "Whosoever goes up the gutter, then you can get in, you can smite the Jebusites." And so I want you to notice this right here. You see that real tight U? Right? From there to there is 37 feet. Right? That's a little bit taller than our columns here, all right? Those columns are probably a little over 20, maybe 25 feet. So you can maybe think about where the lights are at up above your head back here that are shining this way to the pew you're sitting on, and that's about how deep that shaft is. It is a vertical shaft. For those young people that don't know the difference between vertical and horizontal, it's up and down, not sideways. All right? 37 feet from where you see the blocked exit of the tunnel down to the lower tunnel. All right? And so what would happen is the Jebusites, they didn't come outside of the city wall where the ground was at. They had dug a horizontal tunnel here. They would come to that point right there, and they would drop a rope down with a bucket. And they would pull up their water, and they would carry it back inside the city. Nobody could see that from the outside. This was the water supply that King Hezekiah did. Do you remember when I told you about Hezekiah's tunnel? I talked about how tight it was. And whenever I was going through the tunnel, I had to turn sideways. There were times when I would have to duck. I thought about this when I looked over this evening and I saw David sitting over here. Big old boy, he'd have a tough time getting through there. Matter of fact, I would recommend him not go through there. That'd be awful for him to have Vaseline put on both arms just to be able to slide through that tunnel. All right? And so you've got that tunnel, and there are tributaries that all go through, all down through here. And that's not a straight shot. I mean, they curve and all of that. And that's why some people think that Hezekiah's tunnel, he did not originally dig it, that it was simply where he enlarged it so that people could go through it, little people could go through it, and that way they could have plenty of water. And then he covered up the Gihon spring outside and camouflaged it so that people could not recognize it as a spring, so the invading Sennacherib army, the Assyrians, would not be able to have water access. Jerusalem had it. Well, before Hezekiah, David used it. Now, some of you noticed the word Warren's Shaft. Why is it called that? Because in the 1800s, somewhere probably around maybe 1860, 1870, somewhere in there, there was a man named Charles Warren that discovered this shaft. And if you discover something, it gets named after you, all right? And so it's called Warren's Shaft, and you've got that 37-foot drop that he was the one that found it, and so that's why it's called that today. But you have David and his men that are at the Gihon Spring. They go over, and he says that whoever gets up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites, and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief. In other words, what you see is you see the motivation that David had. He said, you know, I was promoted because of my ability. When he was just a young guy, well, how did he get promoted? Well, the first thing he did, right out of the chute, he kills a giant. Then he begins to kill Philistines in battle. On one occasion, to get the hand of Michal, his first wife, not his only wife, but his first wife, they said, if you'll get the foreskin of 100 Philistines, you can have her. He said, I'll give you 200. So he killed 200 men, gave that as a dowry, so to speak. And the next thing you know, they're singing songs about him. And so you've got the motivation that David uses. He says, all right, boys, if you get up that gutter and you fight and you help conquer this city from within, that's how your ranks are going to be determined. You're not going to get determined by how long you've been in the army. You're not going to be one of the leaders because your daddy was a leader. You're going to get to be a leader because you earned it. And you know, I think that we've probably seen this in our own experiences, how that maybe you can take a business. I think of a business that used to be on Interstate 16 many years ago down at the Soperton exit. And I remember this because this was about the only place to stop once you got outside of Savannah before you got to Macon. It was over at the Soperton exit, and it was a barbecue joint there, and it was begun back in the 50s by an old man that just cooked barbecue, and the truckers would stop and get barbecue at Sweat's Barbecue. Is there anybody remember Sweat's Barbecue? All right, about 4 or 5 of you do. I remember that whenever I would go home from college, we would leave Savannah after church that night, and all we're thinking is, can we get to Soperton before Sweat's Barbecue closes? That was some good barbecue. And maybe it was because there was nothing to eat in between Savannah and Soperton, or Soperton and Macon. All it was pine trees pretty much back then. Maybe it was just better because we were hungry. But ultimately, that old fella opened up a restaurant. And for years, when I started going there, it was already the 70s. But for years, that place was open. But then the old man died. And his kids just didn't have the same passion that he did. And the next thing you know, they closed it. Then it became a filling station where they would, you know, sell peanuts. And they would pump or let you pump some gas, and you could get you a soft drink, used a restroom if you needed to. But Sweat's Barbecue is only a memory now because the old man died and the kids couldn't keep it up. And all of you have probably known of situations like that. We've known of huge businesses that when the generations that followed the founders came along, they didn't know what it took to build it. I think that's probably true in church work. And that's probably why you have churches that have at one time been in their heyday, and then all of a sudden, 40 years later, they're shutting their doors. You can ride through North Georgia and you can just look and you can see churches that at one time they'd run 200, 300, 400 people, and now they barely can pay the electricity bill. And so you've got David, and he's going about this thing right. He says it's going to be merit-based, and that's how you're going to get your rank in my army. Well, the first one that gets up there is a guy that's already pretty much in charge, and that's Joab. And so you see the promotion that he uses and the motivation that he uses. Well, what was the result? Well, you have success. The Jebusites, they didn't realize what was happening until it was too late. David had a plan. No doubt it was inspired of God. And so he enacts this plan, and then the Jebusites are conquered. I want you to notice their attitude before they realized it was too late. Look with me at verse 6, the last half of it. The inhabitants of Jabus, they said, except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither. Thinking David cannot come in hither. What they are doing, this is a mocking. In Eastern warfare, mocking, jeering is a part of their strategy, right? And so they're on top of the wall looking down at David and his men, and they're laughing, they're yucking it up, and they're telling him, basically, even the blind or the lame could keep you from coming in. You can't get in here. And all the while this mocking is going on, this ridiculing is going on, David's just smiling to himself because he knows that he's already got an inroad. We've all seen and read about, you know, the Trojan horse and how that Trojan horse got within the city gates through subterfuge. This is the same thing. And this is not an uncommon way to ransack a place. If you were to look at ancient Babylon, you go over to the book of Daniel, prophetically, what you have is you've got four world empires that are mentioned. The first one was under a man named Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. Well, Nebuchadnezzar dies, and his grandson is named Belshazzar. And old Belshazzar, he decides that Babylon is so great that he's going to have a party. Nobody can conquer Babylon the Great. And so he begins to have a big party, and people say that this party lasted 6 months. He was taking the accolades that David said, hey, enough. And then one night, he says, you know, the drinking has gotten old. The partying has gotten old. Let's liven it up a little bit. I tell you what I want you to do. Do you remember years before when my grandfather conquered Jerusalem and ransacked the temple and took all of those vessels of gold, those cups and all of that? I want you to go to the treasury, get that, bring it back, and we're going to drink out of that. And so they bring all of those vessels back, and they begin to mock and drink out of the vessels that they had captured from God's house decades before. And all of a sudden, there's a man's hand that begins to write on the wall. Mien, mien, tekel, upsarin, which means thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. And that night, something took place. What was it? The Euphrates River ran underneath the wall of Babylon. And you had Darius the Mede. Remember the Medo-Persians? That was the second empire that Daniel talked about. They somehow diverted some of that water from the Euphrates, and the water levels dropped, and they were able to go under the gate and underneath the wall of Babylon the Great, and the Persians conquered Babylon that night because they had a different way to get in. They didn't try to come over a wall. They didn't try to go through a gate. They went under the wall. And so David is there. He's listening to these jeers, and all of that time, he's thinking, they're laughing at me, and those boys are going up that shaft right now. And so you've got this great success. Now, what did David say? What did he do? How did he respond to what they were saying to him? Look at verse 8 again. David said on that day, whosoever getteth up the gutter smiteth the Jebusites, and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. In other words, those people that were doing the mocking, smite them. Now, you know David is a bloody man. He is so bloody, God won't allow him to build the temple. God said, no, you can't build my house because your hands are too bloody. And so those mockers, I don't know how they recognized them. I don't know if they were turned in by some of their fellow Jebusites. But I know that the mockers were smitten because they had mocked David. And all of a sudden, that's a saying, you know. And it's going through Israel. And they're talking about the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul. It says, the latter part of verse 8, wherefore they said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. And so, what you've got is you've got David in verse number 9, and he is dwelling now in the fort. That means he is in the secure section of Jebus. Now, let me just share this with you. Jerusalem, as you know it today, or as you would see pictures of it today, is not the footprint that we see right now in our Bible. What you're listening for when you hear reports is old Jerusalem, all right? Not just Jerusalem, but old Jerusalem. And that old Jerusalem, that is the footprint that you want to see, that you want to listen for. That's what is being talked about right here. Let me give you one other thing. When you hear the term Mount Zion, that is a reference to a high ridge on which the old city of Jebus was built. It was called Mount Zion because it was a beautiful part of this short little small mountain, all right? When you hear people talk about, we've got to go up to Jerusalem, the reason that they say that is because Jerusalem is built up on an elevation. You've got this city, whether you're coming from the south to go up or you're coming from the north, you're going to go up. And so it's always, we've got to go up to Jerusalem for the festival. We've got to go up to Jerusalem for the Passover. We've got to go up to Jerusalem for the festivities. And so you've got David, and this man is now in the fort, and it is now being called the City of David. And David built round about from Milo and inward. So what he did was he looks at the city and he begins to think, okay, we're going to build from this particular marker when Milo was a watchtower. And we're going to begin to build out a little bit from that. And so you have David, and he's got his plan already enacted. And he's beginning, and he's telling them, okay, we're going to start over here. This will be our focal point, and we're going to build out from there because of its strategic position. And so you've got David, and his plan is starting. And in verse number 10, David went on. In other words, years begin to click by. And remember, I told you last week, this chapter is not chronological. Now, we are teaching it chronologically, but you've got some of these things that happen early and some of these things that happen late. And so don't think chronologically when you're looking at chapter 5. But David went on and grew great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. Now, why would David want to leave Hebron, which was a beautiful prairie-looking area? The grain fields of Hebron were just beautiful. Well, when you look at the Jebusite city of Jebus, there's some things that I guess was more beautiful, more advantageous. The first thing that I want you to know is that this place was promised by God. There are people Ralph Sexton included. There are people that believe that Adam and Eve was on that spot of land. I don't know if I can go that far, because I've always understood it to be in the Fertile Crescent around Mesopotamia. But Ralph's a lot smarter than I am. You've got Abraham and Isaac, and I mentioned that earlier, Mount Moriah. And you've got all of these historical things that happened, and it seems as though that one spot of land is the place where God seems to have maybe put his stamp of approval. When you consider your body, what do you think the center part of your body would be? Would you not think it's your belly button? And if you go, well, yeah, okay, I guess that's about half and half, all right? Do you know that the Bible says that Jerusalem is the navel? I think that's pretty cool. There's people that say that Jerusalem and Israel is the center of the world. And it seems as though that God has confirmed that. When you think about the things that God has allowed the people of Israel to do, they did something that no other group of people have ever been able to do. People that have been conquered, and they have been forced to assimilate into other cultures, they go away and nobody ever hears from them again. But you had the Babylonians that conquered them. They went into captivity for 70 years. And then the Persians beat the Babylonians. And Cyrus gave a decree, and he says, you Jews, go home if you want to. Just send us tax money. And so they get to go back. When they go back, it's a desolate land. It's trouble. They've got fightings all going on, because in the last 70 years, people have moved in and they're having to refight and try to reclaim. And thousands of years passed, but in 1948, God gave birth to those dry bones. You've heard that old Negro spiritual, them bones, them dry bones. Well, Israel was a place of dead, dry bones, but God made them live again. And do you know that small group of people, they've had more Nobel Prize winners than any other group of people? And God has brought that nation basically from annihilation back together. They are having advances now in their medical universities. They're having all types of advancements agriculturally. If you go to Israel, you'll find that they export more than they can use in their own country. And there's several million people there now. You know, I was watching something about dairy cows and my exciting life here, and how that we, you know, in our country, we milk our cows about twice a day. Do you know they're milking cows three times a day in Israel? It's just like God saying, well, them heifers over there in Israel, we're just going to let them have more milk. Do you know they have literally tens of thousands of, I think it's an apiary, which is what honeybees live in. They have honey. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. They have developed drip irrigation. Water is in such a demand there that they don't waste a drop of it. I mean, they may have a tree from here to the back door from another tree, and in between, there is no water that is lost. There's just a couple of little nozzles at the base of that tree and the base of this tree. And God just blesses them fruit trees. And you know what else they're using in that water? It's a salt water. And they found that watermelons like that. It's amazing the things that these people are thinking of. And God has brought them from obscurity back in the land. And he promised this to Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 12. He promised it to David in what is called the Davidic covenant. And so you've got God that is just blessing them because of his promise. But can I tell you that it also, from a strategic standpoint, it's very good. The people up north, you remember there's 10 tribes up there. And they had to go all the way down to Hebron. Don't you think whenever they're traveling that they would like to go maybe a little closer to home? So what did David do? He goes, you know that parcel of land that the Jebusites live on? God gave that to Abraham. God wants us to have that. It's a central location. It was still right on the edge of Judah. But now Judah was such a large place geographically that it was a central location where that those northern tribes didn't have to travel a whole lot farther than those southern tribes, and they could come together in a central location. Do you know that is why our forefathers chose Washington, D.C.? It's because, now remember, we didn't have 50 states then, all right? There were 13. Betsy Ross put 13 stars on her flag. I like her flag. You've got 13 states, and what did they do? They said, well, let's try to make it a central location so the folks in Georgia and South Carolina can get there just as easily as the people in Massachusetts and Delaware. And so it's a central location. Not only that, but it's also a stronghold already. David doesn't have to build walls. They're already built. But can I tell you what else he's probably already done? He's probably already thought, okay, we know how to protect because we've already come in through the Gihon Springs. We've already traveled 37 feet up that shaft. We know how to defend it now. And perhaps that's what Hezekiah learned from, is that David covered up the springs so that the enemies could not see it. And there were going to be people that would be trying to come after David. And David fought, and David defeated every one of them. His one success would lead to another success that would lead to another success. And I think that's something that you and I can learn from. When God gives us victory, let's build on it and not get cocky about it. When God does something through us and maybe we get 5 or 10 people and they've been saved, let's not say, well, boy, we did good. Let's wait till next year and do it again. No, let's do it again next week. Let's just build on successes when the Lord blesses us. And then one final thing. He chose it because it was a place of beauty. I want you to turn with me to Psalm 48. This is one of the first psalms that I remember being put to music. And in Psalm 48, we would sing this song when I was in the youth group. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountains of his holiness. And literally for years, this next line, it blew me away. I thought, what in the world does that mean? Beautiful for situation. That's weird to me. Does that not sound weird to you? Beautiful for situation? But you know what situation means when I looked it up in the Hebrew? It means elevation. Beautiful, the elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, that ridge that's at the top of Jerusalem, the city of the great king. What a wonderful, wonderful song that is. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God and the mountains of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the sides of the north, the city of the great king. I want to sing it, but I won't hurt your ears. Well, next time we'll pick up in verse number 11. And there's a man named Hiram. We used to have a Hiram many years ago in our church, Hiram Lanford. Brother Hiram's with the Lord tonight, has been for many years. But Hiram, who is the king of Tyre, is going to send resources to David. And why is he sending those resources? So David can have a palace built, because he's the king and he deserves to have a palace built. I've been in David's palace. It's rocks and ruin now. But can I tell you, you can still feel stuff there. One of the most beautiful memories that I have was when the guide was telling us, he told me two things, and unless I lose my mind, I will never forget these. He said, I want you to know that this is the second highest spot in old Jerusalem. And somebody says, well, I thought the king would have the top spot. He said, the reason that this is David's palace is because he wanted to make sure that God had the highest spot. And so God's house is at the number one elevation, David's number two. And the second thing he said, as you stand here, and all I'm thinking about is how David was standing there looking down and seeing Bathsheba taking a bath. He said, I want you to look to your right. And I looked out to my right, and he said, do you notice the difference in the construction? Down below, you had round rocks, and this rock was round, 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 round. But when you got right here, all of a sudden, the rocks became more symmetrical. They were more in a rectangular shape. And he said, now some of you may be thinking this is recent construction. He said, it's not. He said, the lower rounded rocks are from the time of King David. The rocks that are above that are the rocks that Nehemiah built when Nehemiah and his crew came back and rebuilt the walls around Jerusalem. That was Nehemiah's work. I think that's cool. Let's stand together. Now, Father, I want to thank you for your word. I want to thank you how my heart's been blessed this week as I've studied this. And I pray, Lord, that the things that I share, I pray that it'll be a blessing to those that hear it. I pray that they will remember the verses and they'll remember the historical settings and remember the biblical truths that are taught. And I pray that it would create in us a thirst for the things of God in a greater way. I pray that as we lay on our beds at night, that we would think about the things of God, how that you can use us if we will be yielded. And I pray, Lord, that we would have a heart much like David.